Hey everybody, welcome to another exciting episode of an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew and my site's the stop button. I guess I still kind of write for it.
Yes, you do. And we review good movies and bad movies. We've got a good movie and a bad movie today. We're going to start with a bad movie, although unlike the last couple of episodes, I think this is a so bad it's good movie.
Yeah.
It was really entertaining. It's called, I guess it was originally called Rage War. I think the copy we watched was dated in 83, but on IMDb it's titled The Dungeon Master, and it's released in 85. So I guess that's how it got on shelves, as The Dungeon Master.
Yeah, shelves is about right. I don't think it ever got in the movie theater. Except there are people... I picked it because it was the first... one of the first Charles Band.
Yeah, Charles Band of Empire Pictures and Full Moon, later Full Moon Studios, the Puppet Master company.
And so that's kind of why I picked it, and I didn't really understand that it wasn't just Charles Band.
It's not just Charles Band. It's kind of an anthology. It is an anthology movie, sort of. It's about a guy basically who has to save his girlfriend by competing in different challenges set up by an evil wizard played by Richard Mall of Night Court. And these challenges are just an excuse for like anything that's cool, anything they thought would be cool. So, and there's about 7 segments, and the adventures this guy goes on are like as diverse as, well, about half of them are like sword and sorcery, and then the other half are just whatever. Like later on in the movie, he's trying to stop a serial killer in a movie, and it's so tonally different from the rest of it. It's probably the weirdest anthology movie I've ever seen. And yeah, like you said, it's not just Charles Band, but a lot of the guys who directed these segments, who all get credited like at the beginning of the movie. I'd never seen the credit directed by in order of sequence before. But a lot of the other guys who made this movie are like people who would either work with Empire or, mostly just guys who worked with Empire. But like the stop motion effects, for instance, were done by Dave Allen, who did the stop motion on an even earlier Charles Band related movie, Laser Blast, which was the last episode of the Comedy Central Mystery Science Theater. And Dave Allen is great, and the stop motion is great, but it's also got like John Carl Buechler directed a segment, and he wrote and directed Troll for Empire, the original Troll, and like did a lot of bad movies with decent makeup special effects, basically, including like Ghoulies 3, Ghoulies Go to College, the original Ghoulies being an Empire production also from Charles Band. And probably the peak of his fame was directing Friday the 13th Part 7. Who else is in it? I know Shirley Walker was a co-poser. She orchestrated Danny Elfman's Batman score and then did all the music for the Batman animated series. And Richard Mall voiced Two-Face on the Batman animated series, so there's a coincidence. Richard Mall, this evil wizard that he plays, close your eyes, it's Two-Face from Batman the animated series.
Yeah, Richard Mall in the 80s. I knew nothing about this when I picked it, other than it was Charles Band. And I think somewhere I read that their inspiration was Tron, so I expected some sort of cheap Tron knockoff, and it's nothing like that. Though there is the very interesting implication that he sort of is melded with his computer or something.
And they totally don't do anything with it. Yeah. The way the movie... Well, after like a totally unrelated segment that they don't even reuse later in the movie that opens... And then before the credits, I don't even know how to describe it. The first real semblance of the plot in the movie is you see this guy jogging in California, and he's got a girl. He's the guy who's going to have to save his girlfriend because they just get zapped into another dimension for no reason whatsoever. He's got Terminator vision. He's like working on a computer, and you see his sight, and it's like the low tech version of the Terminator's point of view. It's like James Cameron stole it almost.
Well,
but it doesn't really factor in, except that he's got a talking computer at home, and when this evil wizard zaps him, he's got the computer on his arm, and the computer can pretty much do anything. I really miss how computers used to be magic in movies and could do anything, and the wizard even says it. He's like, you know, you've got your own magic. This
that's why technology.
Yeah.
That's why Bull picked him, is because he was keyed into the computer, and it was his magic versus the other magic. And there's this amazing, I guess, monologue almost of Richard Mulls, where he goes through his name. Oh, no, it's not him going through his names. It's the computer revealing that the villain is actually the devil. Mm-hmm. And they never return to that either.
No. This movie's just a hodgepodge of, like, cool stuff. It's, I thought it was a lot like Heavy Metal, the animated movie, mm-hmm. in that none of the segments are related except tonally. They're all kind of just stuff for 13-year-old boys, including bad rock music, including the rock band Wasp, whom the guy has to fight, I guess. It's like they've got his girlfriend up on the stage, and they're going to sacrifice her for real. And then it's kind of like Stay Tuned with John Ritter, where John Ritter has to almost save his wife from Salt and Peppa because he's being zapped through different TV channels that have not much to do with each other except they're satanic. It's almost like Heavy Metal, I guess, but I'm having a hard time comparing it to other stuff. It's such a potpourri.
Yeah, it's, I mean, especially when you get to the long serial killer segment. Which I think was the longest of the missions.
And the lamest, and the cheapest to shoot, probably.
Well, I think that, was that the one written by the actor?
Because
the actor wrote one of them, and I'm looking at this, and it says that Alan Actor was the credited writer, and Alan Actor was a writing professor.
He was? I thought that was just a pseudonym for all the...
That's what I thought, too. But
various guys,
yeah. No, it says that he taught screenwriting for 12 years at Santa Monica College. And so I'm not sure if he worked on it for them, which kind of... I remember that... what is it? I knew a bunch of... Not a bunch, but I think I knew three people who were at UCLA Film School at the same time as John Singleton. And Bryan Singer. And mm-hmm. so they would talk about Boys in the Hood. And apparently the reason that Boys in the Hood had such a tight script is that, you know, John Singleton workshopped it with all of his writing professors for 4 years straight. And then when he got on his own, he sort of went whatever. But I just was wondering how, you know, Santa Monica College, maybe these guys all... went there? No, I guess I can't really see that, but...
It's funny if it was written by a screenwriting professor, because, man, that padded out dialogue with the cops is horrible.
Goes on forever.
It's so deliberately, like, it's supposed to be funny, but it's so incongruous to the mood that they're trying to create of hunting down a serial killer, and... What is it, like, you know, what are you eating? Donuts. What kind of donuts? Like, he doesn't know what kind of donuts he's eating. Jelly donuts. I hate jelly donuts. It's like watching two amateurs try to improvise a comedy scene. It's kind of hard to believe it would be written out. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe they just really needed the padding. I also liked how the cop car doesn't have a divider between the front and back.
I mean, the thing is that looking through, I mean, Rage War is from 83 or 85, and it sort of has these, Richard Mull is the biggest draw, because, I mean, he was on Night Court, you know, I've heard of him, Jeffrey Byron, the lead, he does still work, and the... female lead is in the High School Musical movies, apparently as a teacher, if I can, you know, read her credits.
Wow.
Right. And I think Well, I think the opening sequence was simply so they could have some nudity.
And it was rated PG-13 too. Yeah, there are tits right in the beginning.
Yeah.
And nowhere
else.
Yeah. It's like they filmed that scene just to get those in there. It's still rated PG-13 though.
But it's 1985.
Oh yeah, granted. Yeah.
So.
I noticed also that the, well, I guess the lady's doing better than the lead man is, because his last role was just in the new Star Trek recently, which I published my scathing review on Cinemachine recently. He's like a tech operator or a janitor or something. He's not bad. Neither is the lady. The acting really isn't bad overall, and Richard Mall is, you know, he plays good villains. He was also Big Ben at the end of House. I don't know if you ever saw that one, but that was 85, and he's like caked in makeup, and he's the kind of big, you know, scary guy that you can cake in makeup, and he's a good villain.
Oh yeah, I mean, just the scene. There's some scene in Rage War where you see his hand as compared to someone else. And that's frightening enough, is just seeing his huge hand. But,
You know who else was in this, who was in other Empire Pictures movies? Phil Fondacaro, the midget. Yeah, he's been in, like, Ghoulies 2, and he was in Troll, and he plays Little Pete. And he's well-known somewhat because he was a little person on Seinfeld. He's Kramer's little person
friend.
Oh, is he?
Wow. Uh-huh. Okay. The thing that I noticed about what everybody who sort of contributed to it was, they almost immediately went on to something a little bit less. Well, like you said, it's hard to explain the movie because what's Ted Nikolai?
Mm-hmm.
Whose name
I
missed.
Yeah, I noticed him. Yeah, he directed a lot of Full Moon movies.
He directed a lot of Full Moon movies, but right after that, he directed one with Diane Franklin, who was in, you know, she was an early 80s actress, and it was one of her last movies. It looked like it killed her career, actually. So, you know.
Are you
referring to
Terror Vision here?
Terror Vision, yeah.
I've always wanted to see that.
Oh.
It's not on DVD yet, but yeah, that was an Empire Pictures movie. I think.
So it seems like they sort of took off right after this. And I think, did I just see this? Yes, John Carl
Buechler.
Buechler did the makeup on, went on to do the makeup on both Carnosaur and Red Rock West. And obviously Red Rock West being a little bit different. Though.
And the makeup is good. It's like all the different components of this movie that you'd think would suck for lack of budget or something are quite good, and you know, sometimes in a cheesy way, like there's a lot of lasers drawn onto the frame, but it's so nostalgic to see that. But then also, like, makeup wise like the little segment that Buechler directs, which is pretty early in the movie, the more awesomer half, the guy runs into a couple of zombies in a cave, and they look really good, and you're like, whoa, this movie has real makeup effects. And then there's also, like, a little ghouly troll puppet talking to him, and he doesn't look so good, but he's just a sign of things to come in Buechler's career.
Well, the stop motion at the beginning, that's the first sequence, right?
I mean,
it's almost too good, because it starts out and it's just really cheesy, and it looks like they filmed it in, like, Fort Worth. I'm thinking, you know, around the Tandy building or whatever they still have down there. Mm-hmm. And that's very cheesy. And you're kind of wondering how this guy has a girlfriend and stuff like that. And the one thing they never resolve, to spoil it for people who are rushing out to track down the European cut, there's this jealousy between the girlfriend and the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never resolved. I mean, it's sort of implied that the girlfriend likes the computer because the computer helps save her life, but they never have, like, a big resolution.
It's kind of the least of my concerns watching. It's just because it's so beautifully, everything is so beautifully stream of consciousness. It's like you're dreaming it.
That's why I can't believe that they had one writer try and link it all together. I don't think that they did that. I think that they just sort of, you know, had their little, their vignettes, technically. Mm-hmm. They had their vignettes, and then they shot the bridging scenes. And mm-hmm. You sort of have this weird...
An ultimate master of evil is a good linking device. That's the same thing Heavy Metal did with a Lochnar ball.
And
for a bunch of unrelated crap, just have an ultimate master of evil.
And all they have to do is, you know, flash into their old other costumes, and yeah, it's just it's very creative, and it's kind of too bad.
I wish more people could see this movie. I hope people do try to track it down. It's because it's just so much better than you'd think it would be. And if you definitely, if you're a fan of Full Moon or Empire Pictures films, this is a must see, because it's not as obvious in like Laser Blast, for instance, where I think Band directed that, or at least produced it and wrote it. And Dave Allen did the stop motion in that too, and it's like there's some stop motion aliens in that who look all right, but the movie is horribly directed. And the weird thing about this one is that, well, the directing varies because each vignette has its own, but overall, even the direction is all right. Even like even at the beginning where it seems a little bit too random, and it's like, why are we cutting to a aerobics class while a guy is jogging? It kind of comes together. It's not the best, but it's got a little bit of flourish. Like the guy who tries to drive through a stoplight and then has to back up as the guy jogs past him. Even in the smaller moments, it's kind of better than you think.
Yeah.
But to kind of talk about what sucks, the serial killer segment is too long and it's boring, and it's only sort of saved by those two cops who seem to have come from yet another movie. It's like people from different, remember at the end, you keep, it's like flipping channels. Remember at the end, like near, one of the very last segments is some kind of Star Wars / Mad Max thing. It's like there's some Tusken Raider looking guys, and then they're driving around in these Mad Max type cars.
Yeah, that was a great sequence with the, because you really get the female action hero in that sequence. And
she kind of shouts, like, enough of this, I'm going to start fighting back too. And then they kind of defeat him by driving straight into him, just like at the end of Road Warrior, I guess, driving straight into Humongous dead on.
It's, with the exception of the serial killer one, which really does seem like it was put in there, I don't know.
I would say for padding, because it probably cost nothing to shoot.
Yeah. The rest of it just seems like a bunch of stuff that these people got together and said, let's do this, this, and this, and then figure out some way to package it together and try and sell it. And,
We've got a cave we can shoot in.
Right.
How many different sequences could we do in a cave? Because then there's that, like, after you've already seen two different cave vignettes with like troll monsters in them, then there's like yet another one later on that just involves the two of them throwing rocks at each other, and his computer is telling him his chances of throwing the rock at him correctly are 0%.
My favorite, wow, narratively, of course, are the challenges that take like 2 minutes. Yeah. I think I paused on one of those, and I was kind of expecting it to continue. And no, it just, you know, takes a couple minutes, and then they're done.
Yeah. Well, yeah, another like, throw shit against the wall because it's cool movie is Waxwork. You ever seen that one?
No, I've been meaning to, though.
Okay, but the plot is, you know, teenagers wander into different wax museum displays, which take them into the basically different vignettes. And all those vignettes are kind of tied together by the fact that they're based on different horror staples, like a werewolf display and a vampire display. But then, just as I was thinking that, there's a vignette in Dungeon Master where he wanders into like a wax museum, kind of, except it's another cave, and all these different figures are frozen, and at first it's like, oh, they didn't know if they were supposed to be historical figures or only evil historical figures, because Einstein is there, but
yeah.
Einstein is just surrounded by, like, serial killers from throughout history, and there's a werewolf there too. And then they start to come to life. And it's just like Waxwork. So it's like, even within this vignette anthology random movie, you have a prescient homage to another movie like that. It's like those Russian dolls where one is inside another. Except like one Russian doll is a werewolf and another one is a midget and another one is a big stop motion stone giant.
Yeah, the stone giant sequence, really, I was, because at that point I was still thinking it was going to turn into Tron at some point because of what I'd read. And the stone giant sequence with the stop motion, it's a very nice throwback to Jason and the Argonauts, sort of in Egypt only not type thing.
Mm-hmm.
They call it the Stone Canyon segment, and all the segments of course have names, which we discover at the end.
Mm-hmm. Which is convenient.
Yeah.
I wrote them down. That one is actually called Stone Canyon Giant. It's not even a title. It's keywords for the production team to remember. Also, apparently the other midget in that sequence, and like, why are there two midgets at the beginning of this Stone Canyon thing? And you know, stop asking questions. But apparently that other midget was Phil Fondacaro's brother, because there were two Fondacaros in the credits. And I didn't think that dwarfism was, like, ran in families, but I suppose it does. I suppose I should watch more Little People, Big World, or whatever, on Discovery, to refresh my memory.
I'm looking at some other stuff. We can't forget, of course, the name of the computer. Of the supercomputer.
Mm-hmm.
It is Xcalibrate.
Which letter X dash Cali BR number 8.
Yeah, which is undoubtedly what Apple's going to be announcing next week at their
which becomes Jeffrey Byron's name, according to Richard Mall.
Which I guess is the Tron connection, that they're gonna do that. That's gotta be it.
Oh, you know why his computer vision kind of reminded me of the Terminator? Because he uses it to get free ATM cash. Or no, he doesn't. He just uses it to get it out of the
ATM. It's just remote. Yeah.
Without having to do anything. But it kind of reminded me of combination Terminator vision and John Connor scamming the ATM in Terminator 2.
Because, you know, the hero couldn't steal. I mean, he has to. It's just for convenience's sake. But you look at the poster to it, which I'll have to get into the podcast.
It's sort of like Richard Mall's head above a computer grid, and on the computer grid is all the random crap, sort of, some of it.
But it looks like one of those computer games. You probably don't remember this stuff, but like Atari game boxes.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean,
yeah,
the computer grid is a very 80s kind of image, just a big wireframe grid.
And the tagline, he is the overlord of strange beasts and stolen souls. It's just...
The Dungeon Master, that title doesn't work.
No, but Rage War doesn't either.
Rage War works a little bit better.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But what kind of title could possibly encapsulate all this stuff? Let's see. Apparently, originally it was Rage War, The Challenges of Xcalibrate, and Digital Knights. Digital Knights might have worked, kind of.
Yeah, sort of.
KN.
What was it? Rage War, the what of Xcalibrate?
The Challenges of Xcalibrate.
That kind of reminds me of Star Wars.
Except it's not spelled how Xcalibrate is spelled in the movie itself.
But that kind of reminds me of Star Wars, you know, when it was from the Adventures of Luke Skywalker.
Or Sky Killer.
Star Killer.
Starkiller, right.
I'm sure, you know, Charles Band. Well, I mean, that's the kind of the nice thing about it is they don't think they're gonna make the new Star Wars with this. It makes the stop motion and some of the other effect sequences.
it's like a demo reel for all involved.
Right. And they all kind of immediately after rose to a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm. It got everybody going. I don't think this movie could be considered a failure by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, it probably was not in that many video stores. Wait. I guess it took a while because they finished it in 83 and it wasn't even on video shelves until 85.
No.
They probably finished it and then used clips from it to get other jobs. Or
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I thought what was interesting was there was one woman who worked on it. Who did some other little stuff, and I just thought that was interesting that they had a sequence.
Mm-hmm.
How this hasn't caught on though, like how I'd never heard of it before the first time I saw it. You would think that Mystery Science Theater would have loved this.
Well, maybe not, because it's kind of, you can't say that it's good, but it's. So it would there would be no point in making fun of it, because there's the only part that they would have an easy time making fun of is that serial killer segment.
Yeah, and the serial killer segment, I think I wish it would, you know, I wish there was a website dedicated to Rage War, but there's not. Just because I can't remember, the actor did write one of the segments, and I think it was the serial killer segment. And it just seems like something a wannabe actor would do, because a serial killer movie's good for your demo reel or something.
Except, like, the actor doesn't do shit in it. I mean, the lead, Jeffrey Byron, he has to be stuck in the cop car the whole time. He's not even playing the serial killer or anything.
I mean, he has that scene with the serial killer toward the end when he zaps out of there and...
Mm-hmm. Remember when the cops are driving and one of them says, "Hey, what book are you reading?" He says, "It's a book that tells the future." Really? Yeah. And scene. Like, and cut to another thing. Let's not mention that. They really probably let them say whatever they wanted to, because that's exactly the kind of shit people make up when they have to make up lines on the spot. It's like watching an improv comedy workshop in its first week.
Yeah, it, wow. You can't really describe, it's not out on DVD, which I am not, you know, happy about, because I would want people to be able to see it.
Maybe Wasp is holding up the release. Maybe Wasp. And so maybe they need, you know, they're trying to get their cut of the DVD sales, and that's what's holding it up. But as much as a lot of the cool Empire and Full Moon movies haven't been put out on DVD, or what ones there are have just kind of been shat out. This could be like rediscovered on DVD. Absolutely, it's Charles Band produced it. He must own it. And anybody who loves Full Moon movies, or even likes them, or even likes Empire movies, would buy a copy of this sight unseen.
Yeah.
I think once they see the list of people who worked on it.
And the thing is, some of the Charles Band stuff is out on DVD. A lot of it, I think, you buy it directly from him. Like, I bought the Trancers box set that comes with the first five and not the sixth one that only has Tim Thomerson and Flashback. But I was reading the connections, and there was this Dungeon Master Rage War was followed by Pulse Pounders, which was an anthology sequel to Trancers.
Mm-hmm.
Had Trancers, it had a sequel to Dungeon Master, and it looks like it was filmed in 87, and then because of the collapse of Empire Pictures, it disappeared. And what's kind of interesting about it is it actually featured from, David Warner was in it. It looks like it featured Helen Hunt, who, you know, got her start in
Trancers
in this sequence. And you would think that Academy Award winner Helen Hunt, they would try and get this out. And it's a shame that she was better back then than she is now. But
you know how, like, Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey tried to keep Texas Chainsaw 4 from being released? I wonder if them being in it actually has increased the sales of their fans.
What was it called? Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Return or something?
It was called The Return of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation.
It never got put out on video until they were famous. And then it was their names above the title, of course. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, Pulse Pounders, near as I can tell, IMDb has a year for it of 2002, but I don't really believe that it's ever been...
Well, it would make a great extra feature on the Dungeon Master Special Edition 2-disc.
And sadly, from what I recall of my Trancers discs, there are no special features.
That's too bad. Yeah, I think there was like a Puppet Master box too without anything.
Well, I thought some of them did have special features because
they were kind of released with special features on
when they came out on video. Yeah, when they came out on video from Paramount, all the Full Moons had stuff. Yeah, I'm actually cheating and looking at the fullmoondirect.com right now, and I do not see any Dungeon Master, unfortunately. But, you know, the thing about what sort of Charles Band is... He did rise to some, I don't know if I'd say prominence, but in the late 80s, early 90s, they were able to convince you from the ads that the Full Moon Entertainment movies were real movies.
I always felt they were real movies. What do you mean they're not real movies?
Well, I mean, you know, you didn't necessarily know that they were shot in Romania and whatnot.
That's production value. I think there's a new demonic toys being made right now in Eastern Europe.
The subspecies ones. The previews for these were really well done.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that just from the video, that you didn't know, you're just watching a Paramount movie and you didn't realize that you might not be getting that. And the Puppet Master, the first one was
in theaters,
well regarded,
wasn't it?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's pretty well regarded. What's his face is in it? Paula Matt's in it.
Hmm.
I think maybe the first subspecies was in theaters. Trancers was definitely in theaters. I discovered Trancers because what's his name? Leonard Maltin really likes it.
Hmm.
Actually,
were Demonic Toys? I guess
Demonic Toys
might
have been.
It's hard to tell sometimes because, like you're saying, they just kind of convince you superficially that they were in theaters at some point, even if they weren't.
Right. And, wow.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's too bad this probably wasn't in theaters and it's totally forgotten, but this is a great bad movie that's seriously deserving rediscovery and revival and all the rest of it.
And
I really hope it gets a DVD eventually.
Yeah, a restoration DVD too. I mean, with commentary from the individual directors who are still around. Just because it's one of those movies where the story behind the making of the movie would probably be more interesting even than the movie itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
and I think, even though I forgot to start the timer, yeah, I'm sure we talked about it for a half hour.
So it's time to talk about an unequivocally good movie.
Yes.
And actually very well critically rated. And yet people kind of have forgotten about it too, even though they have no excuse not to, because it hasn't been out of print ever. It's They Shoot Horses, don't they?
And it is on DVD and has been, well, it hasn't been on DVD for that long, but it does have a nice, looks like widescreen presentation on DVD. It won Gig Young a Best Supporting Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
Had a bunch of other nominations.
It starred Bridget Fonda in 69, so a lot of people must have seen it. Jane Fonda, my bad.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was wondering about. I know Cat Ballou. Did she win an Oscar for Cat Ballou? I can't remember.
Me either.
Because I sort of always see Jane Fonda sort of picking up. Oh, no, it was Lee Marvin who won. With Clue. Because Barbarella, I guess, always sort of exists for me as no one could have taken her seriously with Barbarella. And then Clute, the next year, she won an Oscar. And I think she won, what, two or three Oscars throughout the 70s?
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, she's just great in this one. And then you kind of look and she sort of has done five movies since 1986. But,
Yeah.
Watching,
she's decent. I mean, I don't know if she's great, but she's at least convincing.
Well, she's convincing, but the thing about her is that I think is different from the other female leads of the 70s. Because I mean, there's Faye Dunaway, really, and Jane Fonda, and
another good actress who disappeared off the face of the earth
in the 80s. But that was because of Mommy Dearest, right?
Right.
Yeah. But I just thought some of Jane Fonda, she really kind of worked at having, giving the character mannerisms, which I don't really think you see anymore with high profile female actresses, that they worry about that. But the person who surprised, the two people who, well, pretty much the first, besides her, everybody surprised me, because I hadn't seen Gig Young in anything sort of, that wasn't from the 50s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, great as the announcer slash host.
Yowza, yowza, yowza.
Michael Sarrazin, the male lead.
Yeah, he's got kind of a haunted quality to him. Let's not spoil this. Because it's, you know, it's a really great ending. But he has to convince you of something at the end that is really hard to do, and he does it. And you're not supposed to be. It's one of those things where you're not supposed to be expecting it from him, but you can accept it when he does, and you do accept it.
Yeah, and it's he sort of. I had heard of him just because of that Frankenstein: The True Story. Mm-hmm. Which I'd read about for years before seeing it, and then was incredibly disappointed. But he kind of disappeared. He never made it, and I think that there was certainly a studio attempt to get him up there in the late 60s, early 70s. But yeah, so I guess we have to, because I didn't know what it was about. I actually thought it was about
me either. Yeah.
30s movie making for some reason, but it's actually about a 1932 dance marathon.
Mm-hmm. And dance marathons used to be real things where, I guess they started in the 20s, but they continued in the 30s when people really needed the money. And the idea was that you get a bunch of couples together and literally have them dance for weeks and months on end,
and
the last couple standing, or even just last person standing, gets a cash prize, and people just literally would pass out from exhaustion.
And what's, I don't think this reveals too much, but it's frightening because the dance marathon and, say, American Idol, or I was really thinking Big Brother was the one I was really thinking, is that there's the scene where Michael Sarrazin, who basically joins the dance competition because he doesn't have anything else to do. It's seven meals a day, you know.
During the Depression.
During the Depression, he has a chance at winning money. So he just kind of does it, and then he's talking to Gig Young about this, and Gig Young's like, this is not actually about a contest. Or actually, I think he's talking to Jane Fonda about it, isn't he? How it's not a contest, how what they're doing.
This isn't a contest, it's a show.
Right, and it's for people who are suffering through the Depression to come in and see people being even more miserable than they are.
He says miserable people come in to watch other people being miserable and forget that they're miserable.
Yeah, and so I immediately thought of Big Brother.
Yeah, I forgot about Big Brother, but me too. The whole time I was thinking, God, American Idol. It's really prescient. And, you know, I guess apparently the book which it was based upon was written in the 30s. So it's even more so because it's a very specific kind of entertainment. It's spectatorship of other people who are ostensibly performing art and being judged for it, and in the process their loss of like mental health and sanity becomes part of the entertainment, and it's kind of implicitly understood by everybody involved. This is a really dark movie. But
I watched this in the morning. Yeah, and I'm kind of like, I'm watching, you know, Nietzsche on film more than I've ever seen it on film. I mean, I'm just like totally depressed, and it's sunny and nice out. I'm like, wow, this is just, you know.
I read that Jane Fonda took the part because Roger Vadim, how do you say that?
I think it's Vadim.
Her director, Beau, said, hey, this thing is so bleak. It has a lot in common with French existentialism. You should do it.
And it's going into it without knowing anything about it, I didn't know that they were ever going to leave. I thought, you know, maybe they'd leave the dance competition at some point. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't spoil anything to say that it's very contained in this competition. And the competition goes on for 45, 50 days.
Yeah, I was trying to figure it out. It seems to be about 2 months.
And it's just crazy.
You kind of have to listen to figure it out because you never see the outside world. You don't see the passage of time. And it seems like it could have been just a few days.
Yeah.
A few days that, like, each one seems to take a few years out of everybody.
And even though there's a big cast, people will disappear for a time. Like Red Buttons is
a sailor.
He's a sailor. Well, he used to be a sailor. His name's Sailor, just because of his outfit.
Former sailor, right.
Yeah, who's done these before. And you learn things about the characters, but not in the way that you would. This could have very easily been a talky movie, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it's not. It's I think it might be Sidney Pollack's best, thinking about it. Just because it's so, it seems like it's really tough to pull off in a lot of ways, because it's not a set of vignettes of these people set over time where they talk to each other and you learn about the characters, you know, like an Altman.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about making the viewer as miserable with the human condition as everyone else is.
Uh-huh, and in a reflexive way, part of part of the audience that's come to watch these people gradually fall apart. Because that's what they came for too. And even if all you know about this movie, like me, was that it's, you know, a drama with a capital D and a period at the end, and feelings are going to be hurt and stuff, you're still coming into it to, you know, to see conflict, and that's what you get. And then it makes you feel kind of bad about it, but not, you know, not like Michael Haneke does in a more sort of a dignified approach to indignity, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it, the question,
I just want to say the supporting, because you're talking about red buttons. I mean, supporting, I don't think it all could have worked if, like, all of the supporting cast wasn't so great. And each one of them has to convince you that they're going through this stuff, and they do. And it's not just the writing, even though the writing is fantastic. There's not a lot of writing. It's like, it demands a physical performance from everybody.
Yeah. And it's, speaking of the supporting cast, before I forget, of course, Al Lewis is in it for a second. And, you know, growing up with Munsters reruns, it's hard to remember. It's hard to even imagine that Al Lewis at one point had, you know, jobs that didn't relate to being grandpa. And Michael Conrad from Hill Street Blues is in it. And it's very amusing because he winks at some lady, or some lady likes him. And he played a ladies' man on Hill Street Blues, as this sort of unexpected ladies' man, and he sort of had the same role in this. But Susanna York, who for years was just Superman's mom to me growing up, I mean, she's just fantastic in this, to the point where I'm like, wait, who is that? You know, I can't, I should know who that is, and I don't, because, you know, it's a forgotten kind of movie. I knew what it was called when you mentioned that
that's the funny thing. The title is what's well known.
And I think it's because there's a question mark, honestly, that, you know, we don't see that a lot anymore.
Yeah. Will success spoil Rock Hunter? I remember reading they didn't let there be a question mark in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because the titles with question marks were bad luck. Maybe they kind of are, because they tend to get a little forgotten, like this one, very unfairly.
I just can't. That it's.
Because everything's great all around. I mean, the cinematography, you know, the way that they, the darkness of the big you know, dance hall, and the. You know, chaotic spinning lights that are flashing down on them. It's funny, the movie poster has like a disco ball on it and some kind of like thing towards the 1970s. There's some way that they were trying to sell it already, but it must have been a real complicated movie to shoot and keep visually interesting. But I think cinematography is a big part of making a picture feel convincing, and it feels convincing. It feels like you're in this place in the 30s that has, you know, everything is wooden, and you can almost smell the sweat seeping into the wood all around everybody, and the backstage area where dancers go to take their 20-minute break every few hours or whatever. It feels like it's a real, you know, infirmary or like ramshackle. Almost like a prison refugee camp.
Yeah, the
sound design too, of all that like happy upbeat music from the period in juxtaposing against all the misery, and that siren, and the scene where the girl hears the siren and freaks out. So good.
Yeah, and the at the beginning, you never get a real sense of where they are, where the building that they're going to be in. And it sort of just keeps growing and growing to the point that you forget that there's actually, there's a whole segment or a whole development about Michael Sarrazin getting a peek outside the garbage door. And I'd forgotten at that point that there was an outside, that they were situated somewhere, that I should be thinking about about this, because it doesn't, there's a scene where, you know, these people start dancing together, and they the man asks the woman if they should talk about themselves, and she kind of says, what's the point? And that's kind of the thing, is there is no point. You don't really ever learn a lot about these characters. You don't ever learn their entire story, what got them there, especially Michael Sarrazin, who is definitely the protagonist and has a flashback at the beginning that maybe should inform, but instead he's not, they're not really ciphers or anything like that, but what's important is the present action, what they're doing in this place. And it's just, it, because when you realize that they've been dancing for what, like 7 hours straight when they're mad at each other or something, it just, it starts to wear at the viewers. Kind of,
you really, yeah, you're wondering again, just like the audience within the context of the story, how long these people are going to last, if they can last.
And
because you don't, right, like you said, you don't have any clue of their past and if they're really strong deep down. And that's why it's so cutting when Gig Young says to Jane Fonda, he doesn't know a winner when he sees one, but he knows a loser when he sees one. And we don't, you know, since she's top billing, we have no reason to doubt that she won't triumph in the end. But when he says that, it's like, uh-oh, this is the one guy that we know knows how it works here, and maybe he does know a loser when he sees one.
And the whole way that the Gig Young character works, he, I guess you learn more about him than you do anybody else.
Yeah, basically.
And it doesn't really ever turn him into the protagonist, I wouldn't say, but he has this scene early on where he makes this claim about himself. I won't spoil it.
To Al Lewis.
Yeah. When he says that, you know, his father was a miracle healer.
It's a great line. So yeah, maybe you should save it.
Yeah. But he makes this claim, and for the character to work, he has to deliver on it. And that's what, I mean, Gig Young, who I think I'd seen in romantic comedies before this, and I think I knew, I'd read at some point about what happened with him. I think he had a murder-suicide with his wife or something at the end. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Wow. So, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, before, he's just great, and I'd never seen him in a dramatic role like this. Oh, wait, yes, I had. He's in The Woman in White. Really early, 1948, one of the last Warner Brothers. It's an early Eleanor Parker. Nobody's ever seen it, not out on DVD. And he's just great in that. And I think that's the first time I ever saw him. Sydney Greenstreet's in it, Agnes Moorehead. It's really good. But I'd seen him in that. And then he did some romantic comedies and westerns and that sort of thing. But I guess I've seen him in a ton of stuff. I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, but I certainly never thought he could have done anything like this. This is one of those, it's the horse in the bed role, basically, that this, you know, it's hard to believe that anybody who wanted this couldn't have gotten it, just because it's so, it's going to be the best supporting actor role. I mean, it's just such a great role, and you know, there's so much material from the writing, but then just his performance itself is just, you know, it's stunning. And you said, we shouldn't spoil it, but he's got to deliver on a lot, and he does.
Yeah, for sure. And apparently Charlie Chaplin was thinking about shooting this in the early 50s. And that didn't happen because of the Mann Act, but it would have been a really different movie, and hard to imagine it being as dark, although there's nothing really you couldn't have done. But it's sort of like, What's that really dark Charlie Chaplin movie? It's one of his talkies, and he's like a serial killer.
Monsieur V
Oh yeah,
something.
Monsieur Verdot.
Yeah.
I mean, he's it could have been part of a dark period of films for him if he had done this one too. But it wouldn't have been the same. I'm sort of glad it got made when it got made, and then it's in color because the cinematography again is kind of like what can make or break a period movie. Sort of seeing a period in color, and
And
seeing the kind of colors of that period rather than black and white really takes you to another place.
I think also the Panavision framing from Pollock, who always has been a great technical director, but he kind of ended on a couple of really low points looking at his stuff. He actually didn't direct as many movies as you'd think, given how famous he is. And I haven't seen his earlier stuff. I've seen The Swimmer, and he did some work on that, but I never saw This Property is Condemned. I've always wanted to see that. And I think The Electric Horseman was one of the ones I saw, and then Sabrina, of course, and Tootsie a long time ago. But it's.
This is the one he should be remembered for.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, is this is why I would have been in 1970 a huge, I would have been waiting for every Sydney Pollack movie to come out, was because of this one, because it's hard to talk about it without spoiling certain things, but there's certain elements to it that you have to pull off perfectly, given their placement in the narrative, and he does. Visually, and it doesn't hurt that he's got a really good cinematographer and stuff, but they really create this
Self-contained hermetic nightmare.
and it's hard to walk away from it really when you're done watching it, because it is so, even when you realize that the world is never going to get better, it's still just like, wow.
You know what else is prescient and timeless, and I don't think it's too bad a giveaway. Later on in the movie, Gig Young suggests that Jane Fonda and Michael Sarrazin get married on the dance floor as part of just to keep the publicity of it going and as a stunt. And that is total reality television thinking. This guy, people like Gig Young's character just exist throughout time to produce human spectacle because they know what people want. That was
And
another like, more so, I guess more so Big Brother than American Idol, but the movie has a way of sort of incorporating it all into what we now call reality-based entertainment, reality television.
what I found interesting about the just the not, I guess, would you call the producers the creative? I don't know. It's produced by Robert Chartoff and Irwin Winkler, who were very big producers through the 70s, and Chartoff through the early 80s, and then Winkler's gone on to direct some really lousy movies and that kind of thing. But Winkler, I think they produced Raging Bull, I think, is what they're sort of. Winkler produced Raging Bull, but together they produced some really depressing movies in the early 70s, like this one. And then they also produced the looks like the Latin, the New Centurions, which is an incredibly depressing movie, but not very good. But then they produced Rocky together. They were the guys who produced all the Rockies. And I remember having a conversation once about when did movies really change, and the person I was talking to argued it was Rocky was the kickoff of the movie supposed to have a happy ending, in sort of the modern context. And so, thinking about the guys who produced They Shoot Horses, don't they?
Yeah.
Being responsible in some way for the kickoff of an upbeat ending. It's
and they didn't sell out overnight. I mean, Robert Chartoff produced New York, New York 1 year after Rocky.
No, but and
then,
and
then you also have to factor in that he produced Rocky IV and Rocky III.
And
not much else after that point.
I think what happened to him, just looking at it, is he took a bath on The Right Stuff. I think was it. Because The Right Stuff
was... Oh, my God, he also produced Beer. Say what you're going to say.
No, well, just the... What's Beer?
Beer was this really shitty, like, comedy that used to run late at night on Comedy Central. It was supposed to be, like, a satire of advertising, a la network, but... Because it's about a beer company that makes... stars out of these three nobodies, and you know, as if like the guys in the Time commercials were ever actual stars, but then they have to end up faking their deaths and stuff. And like Rip Torn is one of the executives, and David Alan Greer is one of the guys who gets made into a star. But it's a really dumb movie, and it's kind of like the producer was trying to make one more kind of dark movie in between Rocky 3 and 4 and The Ref, but he wasn't able to.
And then he went on to make Straight Time with Dolly Parton and James Woods. I guess these two do tie together a little, because Rage War should be well known and They Shoot Horses should be well appreciated.
Yeah, the shortest point between two movies is a really long stretch, but there it is. We managed to connect the movies again. So yeah, vibes are must sees for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
I guess that's all there is to say. Next episode, our good movie is gonna be Ruby in Asako Shoes. And you recommended this one.
Yeah, Asako in Ruby Shoes. Korean Japanese movie from 2001.
And our bad movie will be Funland, which is also, I think, sort of a failed dark comedy, failed dark satire of whatever. It has a clown with a machine gun on it, and I remember it used to get put into the horror section of video stores, even though, from what I hear, it's not really a horror movie. It's just a bad dark comedy. But I've been looking forward to it for a while. So Asako and Ruby Shoes.
And Funland.
We will see you all there the next time. And thank you for listening. This has been Matt.
And this is Andrew. And this has been an Alan Smithy podcast.
Yep. Good night.